He's very all present in the room, like the chair. All right, we're at number 10. We'll do the introduction, and I think we have a good time to do it. And again, I'm suggesting that we space discussion, but I don't want to make that rigid. Space it at after number 12, and then the rest of it is pretty heavy going after that. That's why I thought maybe we'd take a break before getting to 13. So the introduction proceeds through five disjunctions to set forth the aim of the book, or it sets forth the aim of the book by through a series of disjunctions. The first disjunction is this, that the question of the book is not whether knowledge exists, but what it is. More specifically, and I'm going to not go into this in detail now, but rather in a few minutes, because the other disjunctions bring this up more clearly. More specifically, there is a duality in human knowing. There are two different kinds of human knowing, two diverse forms. And the question of human knowledge, to quote page 12, is not whether it exists, but what precisely are its two diverse forms, and what are the relations between them? Well, let's sort of leave that at the moment, but not for long as a statement. He intersperses his comments on this question throughout the introduction, so we'll address it as it arises. And today, not later on. So there are two forms of human knowledge. Second disjunction, the emphasis will be not on cognitional contents, but on cognitive act, on the subject, on the cognitional praxis, if you want. Praxis, not a category for him in insight, it becomes a category later on, but cognitional praxis, cognitional doing. Our primary concern is not the known, but the knowing. The known is extensive, but the knowing is a recurrent structure that can be investigated sufficiently in a series of strategically chosen instances. The known is incomplete and subject to revision. But our concern is the knower that will be the source of the future additions and revisions. Lies, your views on anything, you're the source of the revisions. And that's what he's trying to get at. What is it in us that enables us to revise our points of view? So this is not a book, as he said in the preface, on mathematics or science or common sense or metaphysics or theology primarily. Those come as third and fourth questions. Metaphysics and theology in the second half of the book. But the primary thing is the dynamic cognitional structure that all of these fields exemplify. On the personally appropriated structure, so making it one's own. Personally appropriated structure of one's own experiencing, one's own intelligent inquiry and insights, one's own critical reflection and judging and deciding. Crucial issue is experimental. He's inviting you to an experiment there. One's own rational self-consciousness clearly and distinctly taking possession of itself as rational self-consciousness. This is a private act, Pache Wittgenstein. It is a private mental act, a series of them. In the sense, at least, that no one can do it for you. But it has public antecedents. This book is one of them. This is in the public domain, as it were, okay? Not legally. It's copyrighted, I don't mean that. It's a public and this class is a public antecedent to that. And it has public consequence, and the public consequence are that he's claiming that you'll be different. There's something that will happen. Winter twilight cannot be mistaken for the summer moon to the sun. Toronto, 10 months of the year, can't be mistaken for another Thirdly, the book offers not a list of abstract properties of human knowledge, but a personal appropriation of the concrete dynamic structure imminent and recurrently operative in one's own cognitional activities. More than all else, the aim of the book is to issue an invitation to a personal decisive act. The point is appropriation. The point is to discover, to identify, to become familiar with your activities in one's own intelligence, and to discriminate with ease and from personal conviction between the self-transcendence that manifests authenticity and the manifold of other concerns that can interfere with authentic emergence. I'm using his later terminology, but that's what he's getting at. Self-transcendence that manifests authenticity, the manifold of other concerns that can interfere with authenticity. That's probably all pretty clear from what he said he wanted to first have. Need to pause for anything, do that, because now we're going to head into, well, not so much. Well, yeah, we're going to get into the two kinds of problems. Okay, why then does he begin with mathematics and science? So he comes back to it again, and he goes into it, and particularly, I think what I want to leave you with is what is necessary from the first five chapters. Not a whole lot in terms of math and science, okay? Very little, really. If you look at the companion volume to this, or listen to his lectures on the MP3s of Understanding of Being, where he's lecturing on insight, you'll see he didn't make a big deal out of mathematics and science when he lectured on the book. It's not at all presumed that one be an expert in mathematics or physics in order to get started with the book. What is required is that one grasp the notion of insight. So you can come up with your own examples. Where have you had insights? Maybe you've had them in math and science, and fine, then you'd be right at home there. The notion of insight, of the accumulation of insights, of higher viewpoints, and of their heuristic significance and implications. Heuristic is the way in which they open on to further discovery. So that's, in other words, the point is you, in all of us. The point is you, your insights, how insights accumulate in your own development, how at different points they give rise to higher viewpoints because the present framework is not sufficient, and how those higher viewpoints are continually opening on to yet further developments. That's his own statement. That's what you've got to get out of the first five chapters. And he's just giving examples out of the history of modern mathematics and modern physics. Well, not just modern mathematics, but goes all the way back to Euclid for mathematics. Modern science as well. He found an advantage in illustrating these in mathematics and science, but the reader is urged by Lonergan, not just by me, to substitute his or her own examples. And these elements, the word of should not be in there, and these elements are to be identified in one's own personal experience. So that's what one must come away with from the first five chapters. And then, also, he makes a mention of the successive levels of consciousness. And so you'll begin to unfold levels. Now, levels is a metaphor. It's a spatial metaphor. And there's a lot of question in contemporary Lonergan discussions whether it's helpful or how helpful. Well, it's helpful because it gives you images into which you can have the insights that he's trying to communicate. Do we need another metaphor? I think it's a question that was certainly raised at Boston College this summer at the workshop. Mathematics and science are appealed to because of their exactitude, because they exemplify the distinction of two kinds of knowing, and because they exhibit concrete instances of the larger multiform dynamism that we are seeking to explore. Now let's look at page 15, if we could, on these two kinds of knowing that Mr. Paradigm. Page 15. If you've got, once you've got the older one, it's you won't even know because you're in Roman numerals. It's the paragraph that begins, but further considerations are no less operative. It would be about five pages into that introduction. For the present enterprise is concerned to unravel an ambiguity and to eliminate an ambivalence.
St. Augustine of Hippo narrates, this is, no, come back to this, it's a joke. St. Augustine of Hippo narrates that it took him years to make the discovery that the name real might have a different connotation from the name body. So that to know the real would be something different from knowing a body. That's a first clue as to the two different kinds of knowing. Or to bring the point nearer home, one might say that it has taken modern science 4 centuries to make the discovery that the objects of its inquiry need not be imaginable entities moving through imaginable processes in an imaginable space-time. They might not be imaginable at all. There might not be any image that corresponds, any visual image that corresponds to the Rosetta Stone. And yet, E equals MC squared is repeatedly verified in subsequent scientific experiments. And it's probably true, even though you can't see it. So again, a knowing that does not correspond to seeing a body. The fact that a Plato attempted to communicate through his dialogues, the fact that an Augustine eventually learned from the writers whom rather generically he refers to as Platonists, has lost its antique flavor and its apparent irrelevance to the modern mind. What is that fact that Plato tried to communicate? The difference between sense and intellect. Plato, if you want, differentiated those two levels of consciousness clearly, more clearly, perhaps, than anyone prior to him in the philosophical tradition. The differentiation of the levels that modernism will call experience and understanding. The differentiation is clear in the Platonic dialogue. It's clear in the myth of the cave in the fifth. Know the truth is not the same thing as looking at a body or having an image. Something different. Even before Einstein and Heisenberg, it was clear enough that the world described by scientists was strangely different from the world depicted by artists and inhabited by people of common sense. Now, that doesn't mean artists and common sense don't. People of common sense don't know. They do. But scientists know in a different way. And it was left to 20th century physicists to envision the possibility that the objects of their science were to be reached only by severing the umbilical cord that tied them to the maternal imagination. So that's our first clue as to what these two distinct kinds of knowing are. It's knowing that is. In Lonergan's later terminology, this is not an insight, there's knowledge in the world of immediacy. And there's knowledge in the world mediated by meaning. And within that world mediated by meaning, the meaning can be mediated artistically, it can be mediated theoretically, it can be mediated philosophically, it can be mediated religiously. And his emphasis here is this one because of the fact that it points out that knowing is not taking good luck. And it makes it more clear. The artist's knowing is also not just taking a good look. Philosophers knowing, the religious person's knowing. But it's very clear in science and mathematics that knowing is not Human, full human knowing is not just taking a good look at what's already out there. Taking a good look at what's already out there is one of the forms of human knowing that he's talking about. But the other form of human knowing is the human knowing that, in its completion, I reach and I say yes, or when I say it is, or when I say it probably is, and when the it can be something as far removed from looking at a body as a formula like E equals MC squared. And yet, because it is verified over and over and over and over again, it's probably true. And that it's probably true is a form of knowing that is distinct from looking at a body. Is that clear? That's what he's talking about, the two different kinds of knowing. To grasp the distinction. They're both knowing. But full human knowing is a matter of experiencing and then going on to understand, and that understanding can move away completely from sensing and imagining and into this realm that is so, seems so abstruse and yet probably is true if in fact the verification continues. So, the hard fact is that the psychological problem exists. The psychological problem is the problem of getting this straight, the two different kinds of knowing. That there exist in us two diverse kinds of knowing, that they exist without differentiation and in an ambivalent confusion until they are distinguished explicitly and the implications of the distinction are drawn explicitly. The hard fact is that the personal psychological problem cannot be solved by the ordinary procedure of affirming the propositions that are true and denying the propositions that are false. For the true meaning of the true proposition always tends to be misapprehended by a consciousness that has not yet discovered its need of discovering what in Augustine took years and modern science centuries to discover. And that, what is that? It's that real and body. The name real has a different connotation from the name body. That's as clear as the clearest statement of it. Or, to bring the point nearer home, one might say that it has taken modern science four centuries to make the discovery that its objects need not be imaginable entities moving through imaginable processes in an imaginable space. Again, in Lauren's later terms, what is at stake here is the distinction between knowing in the world of immediacy and knowing in the world of immediacy. Is it okay? Do we need to pause before the point? It's getting heavy. This is fourth and fifth that we're going to do. Are we okay with this one?
This is what he'll spell out in chapter 8 on the thing and the body.
Things and bodies in chapter 8. Yeah. Thank you. That's good. Yes, chapter 8 has that wonderful beginning. The reader has probably wondered up to this point. And I got to it and I said, sorry. I thought it was more. So far, we have been dodging the question, what is a thing? I thought it was even more. You're probably wondering why I haven't been raising that question. I wasn't wondering that at all. Okay, fourthly, then, the fourth disjunction. Such an appropriation can occur only gradually. And so the book presents a slow assembly of the elements, relations, alternatives, and implications of the dynamic structure. The book aids and encourages the development in you, and all development is painstaking and slow. So the book is written from below upwards, from a moving viewpoint, that successively sets up contexts only to go beyond them. Until there is reached, now here's another claim that appears early on, an invariant upper context. This is the kind of thing where people start to wonder, or they get a little nervous when they're reading another book. There's no problem with a moving viewpoint that successively goes on. But is there anything like an invariant upper context? So keep it in mind as a question. Don't close it off. And also understand, try to grasp what could he possibly mean by that. these, as he says in the right around this part in the book, it's not that I'm unaware of Gödel's theorem, mathematician. Gödel's theorem is to the effect that any system, he presented as a mathematician, that any mathematical integration will itself eventually give rise to questions that cannot be answered by that integration, or from within the framework of that integration. And those questions then will lead on to a higher integration, which will take the form of what Lonergan calls a higher viewpoint, what Thomas Kuhn calls a paradigm shift. And he's aware of that from the beginning of this book. So when he's getting to the point of an invariant upper context that is not a denial of this, this is Gödel's theorem now is held by systems theory in general, and not simply by mathematicians. As Lonergan put it in one of his Latin works on method, at a given point in the history, in the development of a theory, there can be an equivalence between the sum of the questions and the sum of the responses. But at some point, this is going to break down. And questions will emerge, and the sum of the questions will be greater than the sum of the responses that are possible within the framework that was constitutive of the system. And at that point, the system has to give way to a new systematization. And what happens when that occurs is that things get shifted. It's not that permanent achievements are dropped, but there's significant shifts. A greater accumulation of data is accounted for. That could not have been accounted for by this sum of responses. So think of the sum of responses as a system. And think of the system breaking down because some questions arise that can't be answered from the system. And now what he's saying here is that he is claiming that the approach that he will take will also provide at some point an invariant upper context for all of this kind of activity. An invariant context that reaches great concreteness on the side of the subject. Now let me take this bold thing here and do what I can with the time that we have. Besides the known, all right, this is, noema means what you know, the known. So let's just take that, and we won't use the Latin or the French there. Besides the known, illustrated by the lower contexts, in the history of any system, of the history of any discipline, rather, you can talk about contexts P, Q, R. They're successive lower contexts. So that at some point in the history of mathematics, if anybody could have held it all together, that sum of responses, let's just call it P, right? P breaks down because of questions that can't be answered from within that framework. And then a new summation arises, which we'll call Q. And then that breaks down, and a new summation arises, which we'll call R, and so on, dot, dot, dot. That's an integration of the known, or successive integrations of what is known in any field. Besides that, and besides what is illustrated by the upper context that is Gödel's theorem, namely that this is going to go on forever, that every system is going to give way to another system because any system will break down under the force of questions that it can't answer. besides all of that, there is also the knowing, noesis, that is constituted by the very activity of inquiring and reflecting, understanding and affirming, asking further questions, and reaching further answers. Let us say that this noetic activity is engaged in a lower context when it's doing mathematics, or following scientific method, or exercising common sense. Then it will be moving toward an upper context when it scrutinizes mathematics, or science, or common sense, in order to grasp the nature of noetic activity. And if it comes to understand and affirm what understanding is, and what affirming is, then it has reached an upper context that logically is independent of the scaffolding of mathematics, science, and common sense. Moreover, now this is the claim. He's not arguing it here in the introduction. He argues it in chapter 11. And if it can be shown that the upper context is invariant, that this is what human knowing is, that any attempt to revise it can be legitimate only if the hypothetical reviser refutes one's own attempt by invoking experience, understanding, and reflection in an already prescribed manner, then it will appear that while the known may always be expressed with greater accuracy and completeness, still the immanent and recurrently operative structure of the knowing must always be one and the same. That's the claim, and that's the claim that he will attempt to bring us to in chapter 11. The one major claim that is unique to this book. The first judgment made in the book. And as a judgment, it occurs in chapter 11. He's not asking you now to assent to this. He's saying this is where we're headed. He's not pulling any punches. He's not hiding anything. We'll head towards this. Everything prior to it is leading up to it, and everything subsequent to it follows from it. I can make one philosophical judgment that no matter how much more refinement I will give to it, I will not go back on its basic structure. The basic structure of what I'm referring to. That's the point. That the imminent and recurrently operative structure of the knowing will always be the same. It's the judgment of the self-affirmation of the Lord that is the point of chapter 11 in the book. So is that clear, what he's doing? I don't want to, we can't argue the claim, that this is the claim that he's going to make. That this all changes. Okay. And this will all change, and it will continue to change until we reach the beatific vision. And even then, we'll just be moving more and more deeply into truth. But the structure of that moving into it will always be more and more simple. Okay. And fifthly, the order is governed not by abstract considerations of logical or metaphysical priority, but by concrete motives of pedagogical efficacy. This procedure, then, is not the logical procedure of definition, postulation, inference. It's not a logical book. It's not illogical, but it's not a book of logic. This procedure is, as it comes back to Nadia's question, a pre-logical and even preconceptual mode of communication. Communicating insights in a manner that is analogous to evoking images or suggesting feelings. The illustrations are simple for the most part, and the point is not logical completeness, but an insight into insight. Nor does the book begin from a presupposed and unexplained metaphysics. The book begins from you, any sufficiently cultured consciousness, and it expands in virtue of the dynamic tendencies of that consciousness itself, and it heads through an understanding of all understanding to a basic understanding of all that can be understood. And here's the other major claim. Thoroughly understand what it is to understand. And not only will you understand the broad lines of all there is to be understood, if also you will possess a fixed base and invariant pattern opening upon all physical elements of understanding. Those two things, the subject, the point, place of the subject as foundational in a sense that is not propositional, and is not Cartesian, that is operational. Those are the major claims to the book. Appropriation will lead to the insight that understanding correctly is knowing. That's what human knowing is. Human knowing is understanding correctly. Or is the correct understanding of experience. One will avoid, and this is, I just want to see if this statement can also be tremendously obscure. One will avoid the bog of a knowing that is without understanding. Empiricism, positivism, these are philosophical positions that do not include understanding in their account of what human knowing is. So we can avoid that. But also the immanentism, the idealism, the relativism that will cling to understanding but sacrifice knowing. So, immanentism, idealism, relativism, they acknowledge understanding. They say that understanding creates the world that we know, and that's all we know are our own creations. So they cling to understanding but sacrifice knowing because they do not move on from understanding to judgment. Critical realism will acknowledge understanding but say that it is just a step, an important step, but we must go beyond. From the horns of that dilemma, this is one of the toughest sentences. One escapes only through the discovery, and one has not made it yet if one has no clear memory of its startling strangeness, that there are two quite different realisms. There's the realism of the child in the world of immediacy, an incoherent realism, half animal and half human. That when it's philosophically formulated, it poses as a halfway house between materialism and idealism. Well, I'm not a materialist, but I know, because I've got this contact with what's already out there. But I don't want to deny God and soul and so on and so forth. So it's a halfway house between materialism and idealism. And there's an intelligent and reasonable realism between which and materialism the halfway house is idealism. Okay. The halfway house is the philosophy that acknowledges the point of understanding. But does not move up to judgment. So there's a realism. Philosophically, it would be the realism of the Gilsonian branch of Thomist epistemology, where there is an immediate judgment of existence. And it's in that immediate judgment of existence that I am in contact with the real world. That's like I'm as much in contact with it as I am by pondering something, by opening my eyes and seeing it. And I see being, according to Gilson. Okay? That, for Lonergan, is the incoherent realism between materialism and idealism, where the judgment occurs at the beginning. He's talking about a realism that starts not with the judgment of existence, but with the experience of data. Experience of data moves through understanding, but doesn't stop at it. But verifies its understanding and concludes with judgment. This is the critical realism. That, in his claim, acknowledges all of the steps that occur in the world. Is that, am I making any sense out of these two forms of realism? There is a realism that is. It's not material. Gilson's not a materialist. He believes in God, but he doesn't claim that he sees God. He's not a materialist. But he's got this judgment at the beginning. And for Longman, judgment is judgment as an assent based on evidence is not at the beginning of the process. It's at the conclusion of any step coming to that. Okay, and one paragraph that I just want to look at on page 22, an overlook of the, overview of the book, and then we can just discuss here. The beginning, then, not only is, oh, this is a longer paragraph. Let's sit down for this one. Not only is self-knowledge and self-cultivation, but also the criterion of the real. So again, it's a claim that he's claiming that I will offer a criterion by which one can ascertain whether or not one has reached the real. If to convince oneself that knowing is understanding, one ascertains that knowing mathematics is understanding, and knowing science is understanding, and the knowledge of common sense is understanding, one ends up not only with a detailed account of understanding, but also with a plan of what there is to be known. The many sciences lose their isolation from one another. The chasm between science and common sense is bridged. The structure of the universe proportionate to our intellect is revealed. And as that revealed structure provides an object for metaphysics, so the initial self-criticism provides a method for explaining how metaphysical and anti-metaphysical affirmations arise, for selecting those that are correct, for eliminating those that patently spring from a lack of accurate self-knowledge. Further, as a metaphysics is derived from the known structure of one's knowing, so an ethics results, so we're moving on now, from knowledge of the compound structure of one's knowing and doing. And as the metaphysics, so too the ethics, prolongs the initial self-criticism into an explanation of the origin of all ethical positions and into a criterion for passing judgment on each of them. Nor is this all. Still further questions press upon one. They might be ignored if knowing were not understanding, or if understanding were compatible with the obscurantism that arbitrarily brushes questions aside. But knowing is understanding, and understanding is incompatible with the obscurantism that arbitrarily brushes questions aside. The issue of transcendent knowledge has to be faced. Can we know more than the intelligibility imminent in the world of possible experience? If we can, how can we conceive it? If we can conceive it, how can we affirm it? If we can affirm it, how can we reconcile that affirmation with the evil that tortures too many human bodies, darkens too many human minds, hardens too many human hearts? Such are the questions of the last two chapters, and so on. So that's all I want to do.
In that direction.
Cora.
On number 15, the first line, appropriation will lead to the insight that understanding correctly is knowing. Mm-hmm. That italicized is encapsulating a bit of a confusion that I'm having right now, because I have wanted to hold the distinction in the activities, and I think you said it, the distinction of insight as understanding, but knowing as being a more comprehensive, fuller and complete activity,
right,
that includes understanding.
Right.
So is there an equivalence? Understanding correctly is knowing?
The correctly is what adds the judgment.
Isn't oh, so? Right.
Aha.
Okay. There is that tension.
Correct.
Oh, I'm going to go jump off.
Correctly adds the what I think what you're looking for.
Yeah.
Or another way of putting it is the correct understanding of experience. Okay. It's experience, understanding, judgment. But judgment is the acknowledgement that the understanding is adequate.
So you've never been, I mean, a couple of times I thought I heard the word understanding and all that that tells us equivalent with knowing. Not
knowing is experiencing understanding.
Yes.
Yes,
that's right.
Yeah. No, but no, but it, I mean, it, obviously, in the book, he is emphasizing the role of understanding, mm-hmm. because he says it's frequently overlooked, and so, and in the preface and the introduction, he's making it very clear that that's the central act that he's talking about. But knowing is the three levels.
Okay.
Yes, Sean.
You mentioned Kuno on several occasions, and I'm trying to see if I have this right. While the transcendental method of experience understand, judge decide, and insight itself transcend PQR, particular insights are themselves contextual or historically rooted. So Ptolemy, to use Kuhn's example, Ptolemy's insight was true in context P, in his own time, but then when Copernicus comes along, his insight then is a higher viewpoint.
Okay.
How do you...
This is where the equivalence, I'm glad you raised the question, because the equivalence of Lonergan's higher viewpoint with Kuhn's paradigm shifts goes only so far, and then you have to make further distinctions on it. If Ptolemy's insight continued to be verified, then it would continue probably to be true, but in fact we've falsified it, and so in a very definite sense it never was true. It worked within a framework, but it never was true.
It never was.
And verification in science will never reach more than probably true. The very structure of scientific verification is not capable of reaching anything more than probably true. If I can do this in a very brief schema, which I know is oversimplifying it, but the structure of scientific verification is the following. A hypothesis, scientists, after a series of experiments or whatever, Galileo, the experiments of the Tower of Pisa with the falling bodies and the inclined planes and all of that stuff, they finally arrives at a hypothesis that the distance is proportional to the square of the time. Okay. Now he presents that as a hypothesis. This seems to be what accounts for the data. And then there's further experimentation to verify the hypothesis. And the logical form of that is if A, then B. A now being the hypothesis. So if A is true, then B will follow. And then, or C and D and so on, but we ought to do one at a time. So if A, then B. Okay. So sets up the conditions for the experiment, and sure enough, B follows. That does not prove A. It logically doesn't prove it. It just doesn't falsify that. That's all. And scientific experimentation goes that way. And that's an oversimplification, but the conclusions are simply further approximate verification. But you never get an unconditioned judgment that A is correct by this structure of verification. And if in fact you get if A then B and you do the experiment and B is crossed out, then A is out. And you can absolutely falsify a hypothesis, but you can't absolutely verify by the structure of scientific. So Ptolemy's, now I think for Kuhn there's a relativism in that Lonergan would not go with. If Ptolemy's insight is falsified at some point, then it never was true. Okay, it might have worked within a framework. And that is to say, made sense out of the world for people who were in that framework. But if it was falsified, then it was not true.
That would be a postmodern line of thought.
Yeah.
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 Did that make sense to everyone, to this structure? Yes.
In 13, the way it's written, maybe this is the way it appears to me, because my background is mathematics.
It is.
But the way it's written, it appears to imply that there's some sort of like movement from the lower context to the upper context, but they're really two separate things.
Let me look at this. Let me see, how did I word it here? They are two distinct things.
So, like Gödel's theorem, I mean, it seems like it's a red herring to me, because it's not. It says, okay, because then it will be moving towards an upper context. I mean, it gives you the whole idea that from the lower context, these things are, our knowledge is expanding, we're moving towards this invariant upper context.
Oh, I don't mean to say that. What Lonergan is doing is what he's doing there, that's not, that isn't what he means.
I think I get that.
He means, you could fill this data in here for me a lot better than, but the history of geometry, okay? There's Euclid, and then whatever happens in between Euclid and 19th century geometry, which recognizes the incompleteness of Euclid, and then there are successive geometrical systems. Those systems are what are the PQR. They would be instances of what the PQR would be in this setup here. And that Euclid doesn't completely fall out, because within a certain framework and so on, there are still Euclidean geometry still accepted. But there are many questions that arose that it can't handle. And so Q arises subsumes into itself what is valid in Euclid, but goes on to more than R and so on and so forth. All right. And Gödel's theorem is saying that will continue. That will continue. And
what he's saying is that what he's talking about is different from that.
It's different.
That there's no regress.
These are both. The succession of systems and Gödel's theorem that talks about the succession of systems are both lower context.
That's right. So he's
in addition to that.
He's claiming that what he's talking about here is immune to that, because the only way to continue doing what he's doing is to do what he's saying. So there's nowhere.
He's saying that's what's responsible for this is an invariant upper context that proceeds in this way, from experience to questioning to understanding to further questioning to judgment. And that the structure of that is not subject to medical condition.
So Kuhn's paradigm shift is lower context.
That's right. Yeah. And Lonergan's higher viewpoints are lower context as well. But the source of the higher viewpoint is this structure of the inquiring and reflecting. Is that
right? Yeah.
Okay. I'm glad you raised that. See, those parts of that introduction, those are the tough ones. That thing and then the thing about ideas. If we've got that, we've got this basic sense of it, then we're going to go afterwards. Anybody? Well, it's okay, so chapter one. Does anyone here, Sheldon, are you theoretical physics? I need someone to help me when we get into relativity and quantum. Just to have the best. I've taught this stuff about a number of times, but I'm still insecure.
I'm rusty.
Well, I'll do what I can, but if you can do better, do not hesitate to jump in.
All right,
that's the case. All right.
But that's not so much next to this.
Did everything?
So I mean that no one's gonna.